Hello, everyone. This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Ciriaco Acta in the Philippines.
Yeah, hello, everyone. Mabuhay from the Philippines, and hello to the NSA agents who are probably listening in.
And your most recent essay you wrote, it's for the alternative right. It's called Post-Westphalian Nationalism and the Restart of History. I guess where we can get started is the original, the sort of modern concept of nationalism was envisioned by the thinkers of the Enlightenment. And that's interesting to point out because I guess that kind of concept of nationalism a lot of people accept as something that's basically been around forever. But
yeah.
Before you get to that, what was sort of the natural norm before that?
Well, we have to remember that nationalism, as we know it, was created by Western civilization. The nation state was created by the Western civilization. For most of history, that wasn't really the case. You had The authority of the nations were either composed of tribes, of clans, of feudal groups, monarchies, and to say that these groups were states as we understand them today is not really right, and we have to remember also that the traditional definition of the nation state is a monopoly on violence. And the truth is that before the rise of the nation states, although governments imposed their own laws, they never actually claimed to have the right or the monopoly of violence. So the situation here, with these kinds of groups was that people still had people still had a certain degree of freedom vis-a-vis the state. Where let me put it this way: in ancient Greece, when murder was considered a civil crime. The same is true in Middle Eastern culture. The same was true in Northern Europe, pre-Christian Northern European culture, where you had the werguilds. In Islamic culture, you had the kisas, which basically means blood money, which you pay to the family.
You're saying that it was a crime against the other individual instead of a crime against the state?
Not against. Yes, exactly. I'm saying that all the crimes committed in the nation state is considered as a crime against the state. And but before that, civil crimes included murder and those kinds of things. But the state never actually was never actually involved in those kinds of things. If you killed someone, that's between you and the guy you killed and their families. Whereas when the state became involved, the status of crimes like murder and theft and robbery and all those kinds of stuff ceased to have a civil dimension and became a crime against the state. The nation state is more totalitarian than previous forms of government, like feudalism, the Mandarin, the bureaucratic Mandarin system that Chinese had, because those systems, even though they were very powerful, were not very totalitarian. The idea behind the nation state is that the state state governs all things of the individual. That was where you had the first total political man. It was that was the moment that totalitarianism could be said to have arisen.
So all collective consciousness has that's external to the authority of the state has to be suppressed.
Yes, exactly, because the state is not just a monopoly in violence, it's also a monopoly on collective interests, which is to say that the state says that the best interests of the people of America is like this, 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 and this. And if someone were to say, no, that's not in my best interest, you're basically fighting against the state. And so the state can basically criminalize you. In theory, it can criminalize you because you are opposing the general will, the idea that the nation is just a social, it's a social construct, it's a social contract between individuals who have a sovereign interest, and to oppose the general will, the social contract, you are also opposing the moral authority of the state. Because you are opposing the moral authority of the state, opposition to the state becomes essentially a form of sin, political sin, anyway.
So you make the argument that a globalization is an offset of this concept of nation-state rather than what most people, what you would usually hear is that globalism is the polar opposite of the nation-state, but you make the argument that it's an offset of the nation-state.
Yeah, it's actually a prelude to the nation-state because when you think about previous civilizations, like, for example, Islamic civilization. You didn't have nation states in Islamic civilization. You had Dar al-Islam and Dar al-Harb. Dar al-Harb means all those lands outside of Islam, and Dar al-Islam, all those lands within Islam. You didn't have Jordan, you didn't have Egypt, you didn't have Indonesia. You just had one big, gigantic Islamic empire where all Islamic nations belonged to. With the nation state, it's a little different. It says that a certain group of people within a certain area who in theory have entered into a social contract are now part of that nation. So essentially, what the nation state does is that no matter your religion, no matter what your race or ethnicity or your language, as long as you are part of the social contract, which is an abstraction, you are part of the nation state. Now, when we take that to the logical conclusion, all nation states are essentially just social contracts. America is a social contract. The Philippines is a social contract. The PRC is a social contract. So the idea is that we should get rid of all these different social contracts and just have one big social contract, globalism. So you go from one abstraction and then you go to a much larger version of that abstraction. And so you have the jump from nation state to globalism.
Let
me just add that Ramon Bernard, who is also a writer for Alternative Right, made a similar argument and said that globalism is just the result of the nation state.
So the national interest is framed instead of a national interest, it's framed as a global interest. As what's best for the good of the global good, or the global economic system.
Yeah. Well, because in the nation state, what's good for the nation, and the nation is just a social contract between various individuals. That's the theory. That's not the fact, but that's what the message is. Now, in our global state, in the global world today. We're no longer talking about the nation state, but or national interests, but we're talking about global interests. Now, let me just backpedal for a moment and sit and examine how the this phenomenon worked. Back in the 1800s, 1900s, at around the zenith of Western civilization, the rest of the world didn't work as nation states. They were still empires. They were still tribes. They were still theocracies for Islamic civilization, for example. But when they saw how Western society operated, when they saw it, the power of the West, of Western civilization, they decided that they need to catch up, right? So what we did, and Japan is a good example of this, is that they got rid of the feudal structure. They got rid of the imperial structure, and they got rid of the clan structure. Japan, for example, during the Bakumatsu period, when I think it was Commodore Perry landed in Japan, the Japanese immediately saw how advanced Western society is, and they decided that they needed to catch up. So what happened was that the traditional shogunate, which is a feudal structure, you had these clans and families ruling these various fiefs, and they all answered to the shogun, and the shogun answered to the emperor, and there was really no clear boundary except for the structure of the family as clan, the family as from the lowest samurai to the highest emperor. Everything was structured in its own hierarchical feudal way. When Perry landed, that structure went away, and Japan took on adopted the nation state. So it got rid of all those hierarchies and began Westernizing itself. The idea is that Western civilization is more powerful. Not necessarily superior, but it is more powerful. So, step two, we need to become as powerful as Western civilization. So what do? We need to adopt what they're doing. So step three, you adopt the nation state in order to have Westernization. The adoption of the nation state was similar to the adoption of Westernization, and by definition, the adoption of progress, the idea of progress and development. Fast forward today, the idea is still that we must keep up with the trends, with global trends, which is to say that since the reason we adopted the nation state in the first place is so that we can become as rich and powerful as Western civilization. However, today the nation state is limits power development and economic growth because it is local. Whereas global growth offers more possibilities. So the idea is that the nation state was useful in making the nation powerful, but today globalism is a much better model of the nation state. So for the sake of economic and social development, we must get rid of the nation state and achieve globalization. And the reason why we're doing that is because we want more power, we want more wealth, we want more development.
So, yeah, I mean, you
so that's
point
the
out
idea.
To,
why?
A Pew Research poll, is this in the United States?
Yeah, yeah. No. The Pew Research was done for the entire world.
Okay, so it says 90% of the respondents said they favor more international trade, and a solid majority actually support the influence of multinational corporations. So
definitely.
Does it go
the reason,
into specifics by country, or it's just totally general?
It's totally general. The Pew Research that I cited was actually done on global trends, and specifically among developing countries like mine. And the reason why the research was done on that was to measure how far new and developing nations like the BRIC nations are going to get vis-a-vis the developed world.
So you would say that the developing countries are actually more sympathetic or more supportive of globalism than the wealthier countries?
Well, no. I would say that they want to have their cake and they want to eat it. It's kind of like that. On the one hand, they want more global trade. They want more influence of multinational corporations. But at the same time, they want to have a strong nation state. But unfortunately, those two things are contradictions, because you can't have more globalization without abolishing the nation state. Let me give you an example. In 2015, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations will form the ASEAN Economic Community, which is somewhat similar to the EU. And the reason why we're forming that that community basically has will reduce tariffs, will increase trade, will increase direct foreign investment. So the idea is that basically have more globalism in the region, to have more trade, to have more multinational corporations in Southeast Asia. And the reason why we're doing that is because we want to compete, to be globally competitive with China and the US. So the logic here is that in order to become more competitive, to become more globally competitive, you have to lose some of your national sovereignty, which is not to say that Filipinos or third worlders don't want national sovereignty. It's just that they are looking for, it's just that wealth and prosperity is a much higher priority.
And I think you've talked about this in one of the other shows we did, is there's the argument that there's the cultural argument and the economic argument, how people want it, they kind of want it both ways, but they're willing to trade the effects of sort of large numbers of jobs in the short term were effects on their sovereignty and degradation of their culture?
Well, yes, but you also have to remember that global culture is replacing local culture, because the idea is that, sure, we love our culture, but it doesn't really feed us, you know, traditional culture, as it exists, doesn't really lead anywhere. Whereas people, when you look at trends, people all over the world are moving to the cities. And the city, if you read thinkers like Saskia Sassen, the cities are the nexus of globalization. So the idea is that even though people want, love their culture, they love their hometown, they love their rootedness. That love for culture is a tertiary or secondary priority compared to economic growth. And so it's really a question of priorities. And the fact is that all over the world, number one priority is economic growth and power, and that's just how it is.
And economically, there's the debate about whether economically globalization is good for poorer countries. And I mean, the thing is, globalization leads to more sort of exploitation and lower labor conditions. But I mean, people will trade, will sort of accept large numbers of low-wage jobs. I mean, they'll go along with that deal, even though it's probably bad in the long run, and it leads to greater income inequality in the short term, people will sort of go along with that if it offers them jobs in the short term.
Well, you have to remember, Robert, that oppression and degradation is a relative term. If your other alternative is to have a miserable lifestyle for the sake of being treated fairly, just get the low income job, because that low income job is a much better alternative to what you already have. So the argument that globalism is good for the developing countries.
So you've written about what you say with the crisis of the nation state is you mentioned some of the observations made by Alexander Dugin's fourth political theory.
Well, actually, yeah, part of that is that nation state is a product of modernity, and whereas Dugin argues that we're now entering the post-modernity. Just as an aside, I'd like to say that the article, the post-Westphalian nationalism, is actually a prelude to my upcoming review of Alexander Dugin's fourth political book, The Fourth Political Theory. So I just want to throw it out there. And anyway, going back to the argument that the nation state is in crisis. The nation state is in crisis because the modern world no longer exists. It's that simple. And we are now in the postmodern age and the global age, which is to say that the nation state is now obsolete. And the nation state became obsolete the same way that traditional societies became obsolete, which is to say that how wealth and power operates in the entire world is no longer connected with the nation state. It's now connected with global interests, global multinational corporations, and non-government organizations which have no ties to nation states, basically. So yeah.
And you said there's a choice between identity and multiculturalism or nationhood and globalization.
Well, I didn't actually say that there's a choice between those two. It's more like as the nation state degrades, people will be forced to reevaluate what it means to have a nation. Because you have to remember that although the ideal of the nation state is that of rational individuals within a social contract, nationalism was never actually about social contracts. It's about blood and heritage and history and ancestry and race and religion and all those kinds of things.
What predated nationalism is what's called either tribalism or ethnocentrism.
Yeah. Those things will always exist as long as human beings continue to exist. So the idea is that nationalism was expressed through the nation state, but as the nation state becomes irrelevant, and I believe that the nation state is no longer relevant, human beings will have to express their nationalism in other ways. And my suggestion is that the best way to reassert nationalism in a global world where the nation state is now irrelevant is to recreate organic societies. And in my article, I suggested the use of transition towns, And the reason why I use transition towns is because I wanted to bring forth the idea that you can create an organic society that is ecologically aware, economically stable, socially cohesive, and culturally that and is capable of producing new forms of culture without actually making it all about race. I was actually tempted to write in Orania and what's the name? The one
yeah,
in Montana.
South Africa. Yeah, I talked about that in my recent show with Kerry Bolden. But one thing that's actually interesting to point out is if you look at Orania, they have sort of they basically have a usury free economy, organic, lots of small sort of organic farming, very self sufficient. And you see on the black ANC government, they've actually are the ones who are supposedly leftists, have sold out to the big multinational corporations and let them exploit their natural resources.
Exactly. And Orania, what Orania proves is that Orania doesn't need South Africa. It may be under the rule of the South African government at the moment, but it doesn't really need South Africa. And you have to remember that one of the reasons why nationalists in Europe and North America keep failing is because they are still stuck within the nation state. They're still part of the system, whereas Orania is no longer part of the system, or more accurately, they don't need the system. So in a globalized world, you just need to recreate organic societies which are independent. The key word here is independent of the global system as well as the nation state.
Yeah, and you go back now, to the very beginning, because the problem is with the modern concept of nationalism is it's dependent on the state. But then you get to, okay, so you get the argument, if the state has a monopoly on violence and power, what stops the state from crushing these communities?
Well, the state can technically crush these communities, but at the same time, you also have to remember that the difference between soft and hard power. Crushing a bunch of people in a small communes is hard power. On the other hand, the authority of all nation states is based on soft power. It's the idea that the people in the government have a legitimate authority. When you start killing civilians, you lose that authority. You lose that soft power. And when you lose that soft power, all you have left is hard power. And when you use hard power, you use guns, you use the army, you are inviting open rebellion. And when you invite open rebellion, well, it's only a matter of time before you're deposed, because you no longer have the support of the society. You no longer have the support of the economy. You no longer have the support of the institutions which make up the state. In which case, you get something similar to the Arab Spring.
And these kind of communities, I'm sure they will grow in popularity because, I mean, the modern economy, at least in the United States, it's failed. And you see the growing unemployment rate and the decimation of the middle class. So I think people who won't have economic options, I think these kind of communities will offer an appeal.
Yeah, exactly. Because where you are now in the United States will eventually catch up. Where we are, let me restart. Where we are now here in the Philippines was where the United States were back in the 18th century or so, where we're still industrializing. But eventually, as we catch up with you, we will also reach the point of a post-industrial society, because as you industrialize, the reason is that industrialization is based on exploitation. It's based on the idea of exploiting the low cost labor of a particular area, and as it grows, and as an economy develops, it becomes saturated. And as an economy saturates, it needs to investment, money, liquidity will eventually leave. Because the fact is that a developed economy is an uncompetitive economy. So eventually, globalization will undermine the economies, the wealth, the monetary value of the nation state. And as when that happens, the value of these new or small and organic communities is that they provide an alternative. So yeah, I think that such communities are important economically, but the more important thing here is that they recreate organic society. And the important thing about an organic society is that it has cohesion. People in a nation state don't have cohesion. By definition, you are a bunch of rational individuals within a social contract. So, by definition, you're not supposed to have any sense of cohesiveness. And I believe that America and Western Europe has no sense of cohesion. Whereas if you recreate an organic society, you recreate that cohesion. And that cohesion is what matters, because identity is based on that cohesion.
Yeah, that's what we have. I mean, at least in Europe, nationalism is based on more... they have a stronger sense of culture and things that are ethnicity. But the United States, I mean... You see all these people who are very kind of patriotic, but their patriotism is totally empty and shallow, and it doesn't really stand for anything. They have these sort of a very empty idea of what it means to be American, like the way flags, and they'll talk about freedom, but they basically stand for nothing.
Yeah, well, it's the atomization of society, actually, but to be honest, I think it varies. This atomization, this sense of rootedness, because when I went to Manila, what I observed is that people there tend to be very atomized, very somewhat similar to your average white-collar worker who kind of has that blank stare in his face. Whereas if you go to the provinces, you have that sense of rootedness, that sense of cohesion, that sense that you can trust the other guy. You know, you meet a guy walking down the street in a rural country, and you feel like you can trust him to a certain extent. In the city, you can't feel that. You feel that everyone is out to get you. There's a sense of paranoia. There's a sense of distrust. And I believe that one of the greatest problems of globalization is that it essentially atomizes people and depletes the social capital of a particular society. And because you no longer have that social capital, people start to distrust each other. And I believe this is a topic that has been spoken
and
of.
This was probably the case. I mean, if you look at the Industrial Revolution in, say, England, when people started moving to the cities in large numbers, I mean, that's probably when this really got started, where people didn't trust each other.
Yeah, and because they no longer trust each other, they no longer care about each other. They no longer care about society. You know, I don't care about... They'll say something like... A guy in a rural area will say, I'm proud to be American, or I'm proud to be English, or I'm proud to be this and that. And then an urban a guy from an urban area or the higher echelons of society will say, why are you proud of something that you didn't even earn? I'm an individual. I'm only proud of those things that I've earned.
Which is primarily money.
What?
There's things they are proud of are just purely materialistic.
Yes, and they're proud of basic, and the reason why they're doing that is because they've been socialized to think that you can only be proud of individual achievements because you're only an individual. And that's how they experience life, because that's how they live. Whereas if you live in a rural area, or more accurately, if you live in an organic society, you don't just feel you're an individual. You feel that you are part of something. And when you say that I am proud of this and that and other thing, or any other thing, says that is actually proud of his rootedness. His individuality is the result of his society, and vice versa. Whereas the individual is just that. He's proud of his abstraction. So when I say that post-Westphalian nationalism, part of the opposition to globalism is just one part of it. The other part of that is opposition to atomization and liberal individualization and the restoration of organic societies.
Countercurrents Radio is the voice of Countercurrents Publishing and the North American New Right. Visit us at www.countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.